hello, goodbye. I don't know what I'm doing this. Why more? Bye-bye, go-go, glug-glug, lead-lead.
Yes, I'm sorry that we are running considerably behind schedule. It's really time to go back already. And obviously we'll have to abbreviate the remarks. Today, as you know, is the Yom HaShoah. It is the day that has been set aside by the world Jewish community. It's the anniversary of the, or at least it's around the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which was the last really significant armed resistance on the part of the Jewish people, which was crushed. And when we come to talk about the Holocaust, it's very, very painful. I am sure all of you have some relatives, some family that were lost. I know that I've never known my grandparents on both sides. They were totally wiped out with the Holocaust. And one talks about this pivotal and totally tragic event in Jewish history with a great deal of trepidation and a great deal of hesitation. What can one say? What explanations can one offer? We can sit back, we can offer various theological and philosophical explanations. But ultimately, if you've read about the types of things that went on and the pain that was suffered and the agony that our people and many others as well went through, the only response really is the response that we read in yesterday's Parsha. When Aaron lost his two children, not 6 million, he lost two children. The day that the Mishkan, the day that the tabernacle was consecrated, and the Torah says, Aaron's response can be summarized in two words. Vayidom Aaron. Aaron was silent. There was nothing to say. There's really nothing to talk about at all. And indeed, for most of the past 50 years, our only response has been one of silence. As time goes on, perhaps it's a sign of that we're beginning to forget, and therefore it's necessary to talk about it. There are people in the world who deny that such a thing ever happened. In a few days, Washington and Washington, D.C., where I live, where the United States government is going to open the United States Holocaust Museum as a permanent memorial to those who died in the Holocaust. Well, we think about it, and the question becomes, what is it that we're supposed to think about? We read about the horrors, and we see different things, and what exactly is it supposed to teach us? Are there any lessons at all that we can get from the entire experience? One lesson, which is represented by the slogan, Never Again, I believe does have a kernel of truth. Never again, the notion that Jews have to have their own land, Jews have to be someone in charge of their fates, they have to not allow themselves to be pushed around, the notion we have to be vigilant against anti-Semitism. All of that is true. I am not denying the truth of that. But to turn the Holocaust into the argument that we can no longer be weak, we must be powerful instead of weak, I think is to miss the fundamental point. Because the Germans were powerful and not weak. And look at what they became, and look at the humanity that they abandoned, and look at how a human being can turn into a beast. If all we're saying is, gee, instead of the Germans being strong, we should be in that position next time, we're missing the essential point of what the Holocaust represents. The truth of the matter is, Rabbi Becker mentioned yesterday a very important point in Jewish philosophy. People say, if God is a good God, if God is a benevolent God, how could any of this happen? One particular approach that we take is that God does not create evil. God enables evil to occur because of free will. In order to truly be good, in order to truly be holy, one must have the capacity to choose between good and evil. And although God wants us to choose good, but unless there was the capacity for choosing evil, then we could never make the choice of good. There'd only be one choice. Having one choice is not a choice. They're simply pre-programmed. In that sense, one says, God doesn't decree that there would be evil. God enables people to make choices. And if Hitler and the Nazis and everyone else chose to do horrendous, awful things, that is not really a question, where was God during Auschwitz? But the real question is, where was man during Auschwitz? Where was humanity? How could human beings sink so low? But there is more to that. That, again, is certainly one perspective. But there is more to that as well. We have the whole book of Job, where Job is an innocent man. Job is a righteous person. And Job suffers a succession of tragedies. Job loses his children. Job loses his possessions. God did not take Job's wife. God did not kill Job, but he lost everything else. And he cries out to God, and he says to God, "Why did you abandon me? Why have you forsaken me? I was your faithful servant. Why have you done this?" And if you read the book of Job, Job has various friends, and his friends come to him, and one friend says, "Well, God is righteous. You must have done something wrong. You must have sinned." And Job says, no, that's not what happens. You can't tell me that. You can't come to me and say, I deserve my misfortune because I've sinned. And other friends say, well, maybe God has abandoned the world. Maybe God doesn't care anymore. And therefore, you're just caught up like an insignificant ant when you simply wash away an anthill. And Job says, I don't accept that. I don't accept that God has abandoned the world. And at the very end of the book of Job, God himself appears to Job. And if you look at the last third of the book, God essentially gives him a tour of nature. God describes the wonders of nature. And God says, do you understand how I created these mountain goats that can climb up these mountains and give birth in very precarious places? And all sorts of natural phenomena are described. And the real point is, God is telling Job, you don't even understand how an antelope gives birth to its young. And you expect to understand the mystery of divine justice and punishment. In other words, God basically says, you want to know why? And God's answer is, I'm not going to tell you. You wouldn't understand. Moses, when he went up to Mount Sinai to pray for the golden calf, if you remember, we read it last Shabbos during Pesach, the Shabbos before yesterday, during Pesach, he asked God, show me your ways. And the Talmud says, Moses reached the 49th level of human understanding. There are 50 levels of understanding. The 50th is God's understanding. Moses reached the highest conceivable understanding of the divinity. And the one thing he wanted to know, according to the Gemara, when he asked God, show me your ways, is he wanted to know, why do the righteous suffer? And why do the evildoers prosper? Not always, but very often. Why? Why are there Hitlers? Why were there righteous people and children who certainly had no sin? Why did they perish? And God told Moses, that's level number 50. I'm not going to tell you that. That's the ultimate mystery of what is called tzaddik v'ra'lo. Why is it bad for the tzaddik? Remember, Harold Kushner wrote a best-selling book, Rabbi Harold Kushner, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? And Kushner's answer is not really, as heartfelt as his book is, because it arose out of his own personal tragedy in losing a young child. His approach is, God is not involved in these things. That's unacceptable as far as Torah Judaism is concerned. God is involved. But ultimately, why God does it is something that we don't fully understand. However, what's interesting to point out is this. On one hand, we have the story of Job, and we have Moses' request, where the answer seems to be, there is no answer, and we don't know. That's what those books tell us. And yet, if you look in the book of Lamentations, which Jeremiah wrote upon the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which was also a catastrophic tragedy, in which numbers of Jews approaching the Holocaust were in fact massacred. And you look in the Torah, in the book of Leviticus, we seem to find a different answer. Let me just read you a few verses from the Chumash itself. This is towards the end of the book of Leviticus. And this is the section of the Torah called the Tokhacha. This is Moses' prophecy of what happens to the Jewish people when they abandon God's will. And the Torah says, and it goes on and on, there are really literally 100 verses here. But God talks about the fact that there will be exile, there will be destruction, there will be slavery, there will be murder. And you will stand back in astonishment and say, how can one of them chase away 10,000 of us? And God says, if you ascribe your fate to causality, to determinism, to God's abandonment, and God says, I will indeed abandon you. So we have a contradiction. We have the story of Job, in which we say, there is no theory that human understanding can say why innocent people suffer. And we have the Chumash that seems to tie in suffering to some fault or flaw that needs to be corrected. And certainly that seems almost incongruous in the context of the Holocaust, where if anything, it was the greatest and the most righteous and the most pure who were led to the slaughter. In Poland alone, 3 million Jews perished. And who were the Jews of Poland? Not that everybody was excited, but certainly you had the greatest Hasidic Rebbes, and you had the greatest Rosh Hashivas. You had a culture of Judaism and faith and emunah. They weren't very wealthy by material standards. Polish and Russian Jewry were impoverished. But spiritually, they had built up a holiness of over 1,000 years in those communities. Wiped out without a trace. Are we to say that this was the fulfillment of the Tokcha? Now, indeed, if you read the Tokcha, all the destruction that is foretold clearly parallels the Holocaust. But what does it have to do with sin? What does it have to do with flaw? Are we blaming the victims? And the fundamental answer that we have to understand is this. It's a very difficult distinction to absorb. Why individuals suffer, why a particular person suffers in life, is a totally unanswerable question. We don't know. Sometimes it is the most righteous that suffers. Sometimes it is the most holy. Perhaps because God wants them to purify their souls and merit greater Olam Haba. We don't know. That is the message of Job. However, we are not just individuals. We are part of a nation. We are a nation that has a destiny, that has a purpose. And when a tragedy like the Holocaust befalls the Jewish people, there are two dimensions. There are 6 million individuals who suffered. And why they were chosen, we don't know at all. But there is also a message to the Jewish people as a people. When the Torah says that punishment comes to the Jewish people because we need to correct ourselves, that doesn't mean the particular people who suffer needed to correct themselves. That would be cruel, that would be callous, it would be false in many cases. However, there is a message to the Jewish people. If you go back, you see a very interesting pattern in Jewish history, and that is that when Jewish people were oppressed and rejected by the nations of the world, that is precisely when we tended to flourish the most spiritually. When, ironically, the gates of acceptance are open and we have all the options in the world and we can pursue whatever it is that we want to pursue, that is when we have the danger of assimilation, the danger of intermarriage, the danger of abandoning our heritage. And God says in the Torah, I will never let you forget that you are a Jew. If you try to forget you're a Jew by abandoning your ways, by becoming like everybody else, by forgetting the unique destiny that you have, then God says, I will make somebody come who will make you remember. In 1920, right after World War I, one of the great rabbis who died before the Holocaust wrote in his commentary on the Chumash, on the Tokcha, and he said the following, those Jews who look at Berlin as their new Jerusalem, and those Jews who take German language and German culture instead of the culture of Moshe and the culture of the Torah, shall see that that very decision will unleash a force of terrible destruction upon the Jewish people. If you go back, for example, to the Spanish Inquisition, and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, which occurred 500 years this year, 1492, the same time Columbus was discovering America, which, by the way, is very symbolic because America, to a large extent, the United States, has been a new haven for Jews for hundreds of years. And at the very time that the Jews were being expelled from Spain, God was preparing what would eventually become a new home. But if you look, there was no culture in Europe where the Jews were as assimilated and as accepted in the higher echelons of Spanish culture, or of culture, as were the Jews in Spain. The Abarbanel, the great biblical commentator, was the finance minister of the King of Spain. He financed some of Columbus's voyages. The Abarbanel, Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel, or Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, was so honored that King Ferdinand was willing to give him an exemption. Abarbanel could have stayed in Spain, but he chose, of course, to cast his lot with his people. when they left Spain. There was no culture in the world where Jews were so held in high esteem and were so involved in the secular pursuits of philosophy and literature and music as were the Jews in Germany and in Western Europe. And while it is true, of course, that the bulk of the Holocaust decimated Eastern Jewry, which ironically was on a much higher religious plane, but the source of the destruction came from where Jews had abandoned their heritage. Again, we are not describing individual victims. The individual victims were holy and were righteous and were great. But we are saying that when something happens to the Jewish people nationally, when we are hit on the head with a tragedy of immense proportions, it is because God is telling us, if you try to forget who you are, you will be reminded. One can have an awareness of being a Jew internally, and that's the way it should be. But if one loses the awareness of being a Jew internally, then one will have to have that awareness externally. The fate of the Jewish people is that we will never be allowed to forget we're Jewish. People, Hitler's Nuremberg laws, people whose grandparents had converted to Catholicism, perhaps 50 or 60 or 70 years before, were rounded up in a concentration camp. God does not let you forget. God will not let you forget. And God will use whatever means are available to make us remember and to recommit ourselves. This is what the Torah says. These are not my words. This is what God says. God says, if you try to forget me, I will not let you forget. Now again, let me just reiterate once again two points that sometimes people misconceive when this type of position is presented. Number one, we're certainly not talking about individuals. As I said before, why individuals are chosen, that's the mystery of Job. We don't know why. We are talking about a message for the Jewish people. Second of all, the question is sometimes raised, well, if we're saying the Jewish people deserve it, are we somehow exonerating the wrongdoers? Are we saying Hitler didn't do anything wrong because he deserved it? Of course that's not the case. We go back to Egypt. God decreed the Jewish people needed a period of slavery to refine their character and to develop group solidarity and group empathy. You know the famous statement that the Jewish people in Egypt had also reached the 49th level of impurity, of assimilation and everything else. But God redeemed them because they didn't change their Jewish names and they spoke Hebrew and they wore distinctively Jewish clothes and they didn't intermarry. They weren't religious. They weren't keeping Shabbos. They weren't keeping kosher. They weren't keeping circumcision. But they regarded themselves with group solidarity and empathy and compassion for each other. And that was the basis for redemption. And the commentaries say it was precisely the slave experience that gave them the sense that the people out there aren't necessarily going to be our friends when times get tough. All we have is each other. All we have is God. And that was the basis of the redemption. The Babich Rebbe has a saying that it's easier to be a religious Jew in Siberia than in suburbia. And you can see that. That ironically, it is the most dangerous situation spiritually to be in a galut, in an exile of affluence and acceptance. Because there it's so easy to throw in the towel. And yet, that is the milieu out of which the Holocaust had arisen. We're exonerating the wrongdoer? Of course not. Is Paro going to be let off the hook because we needed a slavery experience? No, because God always gives people the choice to make moral decisions. If Hitler wouldn't have done it, then something else could have happened because we needed that experience. But that certainly does not exonerate the wrongdoer. If I kill somebody, if I pull a trigger, God wanted that person to die for whatever reason, but that doesn't give me a justification to become the moral agent who makes the decision to do something wrong. So this has certainly nothing to do with exonerating the wrongdoers. The wrongdoers, the beasts that committed this action, have certainly committed a horrendous action. But nevertheless, God is giving us a message. God is giving us a message that you can't forget what being Jewish means. And if you try to forget, then you unleash terrible, awful, awesome forces that will bring us back to that recognition. And the truth is, if you look in the aftermath of the Holocaust, you can see that perhaps the greatest miracle of all is the miracle of Jewish survival and Jewish resilience. The Holocaust was not the first time that we were persecuted and destroyed. We had crusades, we had Spanish Inquisition. Before that, we had the destruction of the temples. We had pogroms. The Holocaust, numerically perhaps, was unique, although, as I mentioned, during the temples, the numbers actually approximate the Holocaust. The Holocaust, perhaps, was unique in the use of technology as destroying. But the point is, it is something that has gone on throughout Jewish history. And as Mark Twain remarked over 100 years ago, the greatest miracle of all is the miracle that a small people that we are could have survived all of this. Not only survived, but flourished. The State of Israel was built on the ashes of the Holocaust. The Baal Tshuva movement, the return of thousands of Jews to their Torah, the growth of yeshivas, all of these are things that have been built on the ashes of the Holocaust. Not only on the ashes, but to the extent because of them. Because the loss that was suffered was so profound and so great that there was a tremendous energy, like an atom bomb, that was released within us that we have to go on. And without that push, which that generated, there would not have been that force. Ironically, it is precisely in response to the greatest tragedies that we do get the urge and the tremendous impetus to go on and rebuild. Without the Holocaust, there may not have been a State of Israel. Without the Holocaust, there may not have been a Baal Tshuva movement. In fact, many mystics say that the Baal Tshuva movement comes from the souls of Holocaust victims who died, who didn't have a chance to necessarily observe the Torah. So God sent their souls back to be able to achieve that level of holiness. So we have on one level the response of Job that says there is no answer, but we have the response of the Tokhara that says collectively there are lessons that Jewish people have to learn. Not merely the never again lesson of having weapons and being strong, but the most important part of remembering who we are and what we are. The assimilation rate in the United States now is 1 out of every 2 marriages is to a non-Jew. At that rate, in the middle of the 21st century, statistically there shouldn't be a Jewish people. Rest assured there will be a Jewish people, although how large we don't know. But keep in mind that when one abandons what it means to be Jewish, when one gets involved in intermarriage, one is giving Hitler a posthumous victory. One is allowing Hitler to accomplish from the grave what he was unable to accomplish by destroying 6 million Jews. One is literally a continuer of the Holocaust every time one abandons what it means to be a Jew. Because if you study the works of Nazism, Mein Kampf and various other books that were written, you will see that Hitler's hatred of the Jew was a hatred of the spiritual message that the Jewish people had. He really was. I mean, it's almost scary. All the Nazis had almost an obsessive fascination with even the details of Jewish observance. Jules Streicher, who was the publisher of the Stürmer, which was the anti-Semitic Nazi organ during the pre-World War II and during World War II, he was hung on corn. He happened to be hung on corn. The Nuremberg trials, his sentence was carried on corn. Now, you wouldn't expect him to know that, but right before the noose was placed on his head, he said, "I see the Jews have another Purim, 1945. Purim Fest, 1945. He knew about Purim. He knew about Haman. You have to understand that maybe not the rank and file Nazi, you may not have known about all of this, but the big guys on top, this was not a war against the Jew. This was a war against Judaism, a war against spirituality, because the Third Reich was devoted to bestiality and cruelty and survival of the fittest and an abandonment of the notion of morality and responsibility and compassion. These were seen as soft virtues. These were seen as worthless. These were seen as Jewish. Hitler knew what it meant to be a Jew. Hitler knew what God wanted the Jewish people to exemplify. He knew it very well. And he was determined to wipe it out. And that is why it wasn't enough to physically kill Jews. That is why they had to be debased. And that's why they had to be humiliated. And that's why they had to be shamed. And that's why their spirits had to be broken. Because what he wanted to destroy was not the body. He wanted to destroy and crush the spirit. And that was exactly the thing that he couldn't do. You read stories about how Jews responded in concentration camps, that as they're led to their death, they can sing the Shema. Or there's a story where the last thing somebody wanted to say before he was shot in the head by the SS was the bracha, blessed is God that did not make me a non-Jew. Blessed is God that if I have to be in this situation, thank God I am the one receiving the bullets instead of the one shooting the bullet. That rhetoric does not go off very well, perhaps, in this century or in this decade of activism and taking control of your life. But to the Jew doesn't want to be a victim. The Jew doesn't want to be at the other end of the gun. The Jew doesn't want to be killed. But if the choice is, do I want to be a human being who lives by morality, who lives by godliness, who stands for something that is transcendent and eternal, or do I want to be a debased animal that goes around shooting innocent women and children? If that is my choice, and in the Holocaust that may have been the choice, the only choice that we have, the Jew says, I would rather be the victim than to be the perpetrator. What can we say? The stories of nobility, of spiritual resistance, not just the armed resistance, but the spiritual nobility of going to one's death with dignity, with holiness, is a message that we have to take. And indeed, one of the ideas of suffering, and this is not just the Holocaust, but this is illness, this is infertility, whatever trials and tribulations human beings undergo, we have to understand that God is trying to teach us to bring out qualities within us that we never knew we had. The notion of ennobling. Viktor Frankl was a psychologist who was in Auschwitz. He himself was not religious, but he wrote a book, Man in Search of Meaning, or Man's Search for Meaning. And he writes that it was precisely in the depths of Auschwitz that he saw what human beings could become. On both ends of the spectrum, he saw how a human being could be so debased as to turn into an animal. But he also saw the godliness that could emerge only from the experience of suffering and the experience of developing qualities within the person that they never even knew they had. The story of a woman who would sell her chametz, sell her bread to the armed guard. I'm sure the price was not very good before Passover, because a Jew is not supposed to own chametz. And this was a time when a loaf of bread was worth more, as the lady said after the war, more than the skyscrapers in Midtown Manhattan. That's what bread was like. So a Jew can't own chametz. The woman that circumcised right as they're being led to the gas chambers, she took a knife, which the Nazi guard gave her, thinking she'd commit suicide. He was perfectly happy. And she circumcised her son, because she says, let him enter the covenant of Abraham. The stories of a people who lit the Hanukkah candles, when there'd be a death penalty, do so. Again, they're just story after story. There are 6 million stories one can talk about. There was a story that I read that on Yom Kippur, people were determined to fast. And the guards had said, if you fast, you'll be shot because you're not performing your work quota for the Third Reich. And there was a Kapo. Kapos was the kind of the Jews who sometimes the Germans enlisted to persecute Jewish prisoners in exchange for whatever favors they got. And the Kapo was very anti-Jewish, anti-observant, although he was Jewish. And he said, if you guys fast in Yom Kippur, you know, I'm going to take the law in my own hands. And what happened was, when the SS guards came in and caught them fasting, the Kapo stepped forward and said, I'm sorry, sir, we Jews don't eat on Yom Kippur. And the SS guard took out the gun and killed the Kapo there on the spot. A person who all of his life before the war had no connection to Jewish observance, but at that moment he wanted to be with his people. He was willing to give his life to be with those people. A death al kiddush Hashem. So when we look at the Holocaust, what we should be looking at is, yes, the never again is part of it, but ultimately what we look at is the story of human resilience, the ability of a human being to rise above their circumstances, the ability of the human spirit not to be crushed, although the weight seems to be something that is not within the human capacity to bear. The fact that not only did they survive, while those who died, died with dignity and respect and their values intact. And those who survived did not give up, but they rebuilt their lives and they continued to affirm their belief in God, their belief in Torah, their belief in humanity. Because the real lesson of Auschwitz is, what can a human being become? What can we achieve? On both ends of the spectrum, it warns us against the degradation of the master race. But it also tells us that the body may be destroyed, but the spirit lives on forever. Jewish survival is a true miracle of God. We don't know exactly the details of the Holocaust, but it's clear that having the state of Israel and having Am Yisrael Chai is really God's embrace, God's kiss to an oppressed and a suffering people, to reassure them that even after the Holocaust, He has not abandoned us. He is very much with us. He is very much involved in our lives. And if for some reason we needed whatever that experience is supposed to teach us, God is showing us every day that He's still very much here. There is a famous medrash that tells us that when God created the world, He first created a number of worlds which He then destroyed. You heard this? This is one of the explanations people give for dinosaurs and fossils. That our world might be 57, 52, 53 years, but that all those other worlds that God destroyed. And Rav Soloveitchik, who passed away just now during Pesach, used to remark, why couldn't God get it right the first time? Why did God have to create worlds that He destroyed because they weren't good? Why didn't He make the right one? And Rav Soloveitchik says, because God wants to teach us a lesson that even if we lose our world, sometimes we build up things, we invest things, and our world is taken away from us. This could be in many levels. Our world was taken away from us in the Holocaust. There are millions and millions of people alive today who will never know their grandparents, who have never known their grandparents, who have lost uncles and aunts and brothers and daughters and children and spouses, people who have lost their whole worlds. Individually, we sometimes lose our worlds through illness or in perhaps a less serious thing. We don't get the job that we want. We have many disappointments. We lose things that are very important to us. But God, too, had worlds that He lost and had to destroy. And what God did was, after His world was destroyed, He went on and He built again. And God went through this process to teach us something, that even when our world is destroyed, what we must do is go on and rebuild. Because so did God go on and rebuild again and did not abandon the enterprise. The Kabbalists tell us, and really it's based on a verse in Psalms, that God feels the pain that the Jewish people feel. And indeed, the pain that God feels is even greater than our pain. Because if God is infinite, and God is omnipotent, then God's capacity for pain is even greater than our capacity for pain. God felt the suffering of every Jew who died in the crematorium in Auschwitz. And God feels much greater than we feel the pain of every survivor who lost their world. And if God did what He did for reasons that Job says are inscrutable, God identifies very much with the pain that is felt. In fact, I came across a book that was written by the Piazetzny Rebbe. The Piazetzny Rebbe was the last Hasidic Rebbe in the Warsaw Ghetto. He died in the Warsaw Ghetto. And during that time, he would continue to hold not only services, but he would give classes, and he would say words of inspiration to pick up people's spirits. And amazingly enough, he continued to write his Divrei Torah for eventual publication. He says, I'm putting this away, it will be found, and it will be published. And when you read this, you just stand back in amazement at what a human being can be. As Shakespeare said, what a piece of work is man. There are various prefaces to this, like for example, he'll write in 1942, I am writing this in hiding as there are bombs around me. And there are things that he writes right as he's being taken away. He writes something, I'm now being taken away. And he writes this. And he calls out to the heavens and he says, How can the sun shine? How can the moon function? How can the sky go on? How can the very world itself bear what is happening to the Jewish people? He didn't understand. How can life go on at all? But he says, there is a medrash that says when God destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, God wanted to cry. And the angels told God, you're not allowed to cry here. And God said, if you don't let me cry, I will go to a place where you can't follow me. And there I will cry. And this Rebbe, writing in the middle of the Warsaw Ghetto as bombs are exploding over their heads and destroying the buildings around him, says, what that means is this. God, as it were, has not allowed us to feel what God feels. Because if the world were to feel even a fraction of God's agony, the world would indeed not be allowed to go on. It would just destroy itself. The force, the pain would be too great. And thus God withdraws and God suffers alone. So we don't feel the full intensity of God's suffering. And that's the concept of, as time goes on, we feel things less intensely and we're able to talk about them. But it's fundamental that God feels this pain as well. The story goes, as a Jew was being beaten in the Holocaust, in a concentration camp, and the Nazi was kicking his head and pushing his face in the mud and mocking him and saying to him, where is your God now? Where is your God that has protected you, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that has said he will be with the Jewish people? And the man, as being beaten and his head is being pushed into the mud, says, he is with me in this mud. He is here right now. He is suffering with me as I am going through this degradation. And I know that there will be a time that he will sometime redeem us and give us a geula once again. So what are the lessons of the Holocaust? Never again? All right. Indeed, it is very fundamental. But we can no longer be indifferent to human suffering. There is human suffering going on today in the world as well, although it is not of the magnitude, thank God, of the Holocaust. We have the massacres going on in Bosnia, the Serbs, the ethnic cleaning policies. And ethnic cleaning, of course, is very closely related to the genocide of Hitler. We have starvation in Somalia. Indeed, Jews, above all, should be sensitive to human suffering and Holocaust and genocidal-like programs, because we were victims. And to say that, well, that's them and not us, would be exactly the same thing that people said about us when they said, it's us, you know, it's the Jews and not us. You know the famous story that when Hitler came for one group of people, the other group of people said, well, that's not us. And eventually more and more people were taken and so everybody was taken. That's certainly one lesson. But I think there are other lessons as well. The lesson of remembering who we are. Remembering that Jews do have a spiritual destiny. And if God dealt harshly with us, if God hurt us as deeply as he hurt us, it is only because what we do matters. Perhaps what other people do is not as important in God's eyes. Just as an orphan who misbehaves in the street may not be disciplined because the orphan has no parents. What we do makes a difference. Because God wanted us to learn a message, perhaps that's why we have to go through such a painful experience. But to go through the experience and not learn the message, that would be a total tragedy about that. There would be nothing really taken from this experience if we just go about our merry way and forget the unique and often painful destiny of being a Jew. We learn about resilience. We learn about true courage. We learn about spiritual fortitude. The ability to rise above your circumstances. This is a mini lesson that applies every day of our lives. When sometimes we are beset with disappointments, we are beset with failures, we have personal difficulties in our lives. But look at how a human being can rise above those circumstances. And how in the process of suffering, suffering is a form of self-revelation and self-discovery and the development within oneself of capacities that one never knew they were able to achieve. And look at that as an example. We try to incorporate that example in our daily lives. Our Chachamim tell us that in the Beis HaMikdash you had the cherubs on top of the ark. And miraculously, when God was in good grace, when the Jewish people were in good graces with God, the cherubs would be looking towards each other as an embrace. When they were in bad graces, the cherubs would turn apart. That was a miracle. It is said that the moment of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Jews looked at the Roman, as the Babylonians took the ark, and they saw the cherubs locked in embrace that very moment. That the moment of destruction was only because of God's love for the Jewish people, that he cared about them. He wanted them to learn from this experience, to grow from this experience, and God identified with their suffering even greater than we ourselves feel. And the course of Jewish history since 1945 has shown us indeed that God has not abandoned us, but Am Yisrael Chai. And let us all resolve in our own lives to learn these lessons well, not to give Hitler the victory. Hitler destroyed many of our bodies, but he destroyed none of our spirits. And yet, if we abandon our heritage, our bodies may prosper. Our spirit will be destroyed. And that is exactly what Hitler wanted to do. So let us resolve not to give him that final victory. So I wish you all well, and hope that God should spare us from these further tragedies. Thank you.